Thanks for listening to this message from the life of St. Bees. We're a church that loves to empower, equip and inspire. And in order to better fulfill this call, we're currently undertaking an audacious church relocation project. Find out more, including how you can take part, at www.goandgrow.london. Thank you, and may this message better help you to live a life full of adventurous faith.
What an amazing time of worship, and so encouraging to hear the stories. Like, I feel like maybe I was meant to come just for that last, 15 minutes of just God showing up in people's lives. I love this church. I've been to this church many years ago, came to visit just to hang out with some friends, and I constantly hear stories of what God's doing in this place. So it's a genuine privilege to be here. I love Colin and Natalie. I got to know them years ago. I used to work at Soul Survivor in the late 90s, early 2000s. And before that, I went to Soul Survivor, this big youth festival, where Colin had massive dreadlocks down to his shoulders and rocked around playing drums for Matt Redman, and Natalie was on bass. And as a sort of teenager, I looked up at these guys and thought, like, they're on fire for God. When I grow up, I want to be a lot like that, without the dreads, obviously. And nothing's changed. I still look up to those guys and think, when I'm, however many years, not many years between us, but when I'm at that stage, I want to be on fire for Jesus in the same way that Colin is and Natalie is too. So it's an absolute joy to be here. If you've got a Bible, turn to Philippians chapter 2. We're not going to get there for a chunk of time, but I want you to turn there just so that you know we are going to get to the Bible. This isn't going to be sort of like some self-help. We are going to teach straight from Scripture. But before that, I want to share a few stories. I've just lost signal, but hopefully it will come back. I want to tell you a story of when I was in Uganda. And this was a year or two ago, northern Uganda, a place called Soroti. And I was with Tear Fund, going to see some of the phenomenal work that they're doing out there. They're seeing, it's all through the local church, they're seeing thousands of people come to faith, genuinely mind-blowing. And as these people come to faith, they're formed into tight-knit communities, like small groups effectively in their churches. And they get asked this very simple question: what's in your hand? That's the question that they get asked. What is in your hand? In other words, and remember, the backdrop is a lot of these people are coming from sort of extreme poverty in terms of their background. They owe next to nothing. But they're trying to move people out of a victim mindset to essentially say, you're in a new story now. You're in a new family. It's the church. And we're on a mission to see God's kingdom break out all around us. So what can you contribute? Like, what can you give to the story? And most people, as they join these groups, the answer is, I've got nothing. Like, we live in extreme poverty. I don't own anything. I've got nothing to contribute. And they try and sort of like coach people out of that mindset. Like, what are the gifts? What are the talents? What are the life experience that you could contribute to this kingdom community to see, God move in powerful ways? So we met this one guy, and I want to show you a piece of his land. Now, I have lost signal, so I'm hoping it will come back so I can show you a photo. Everything all right at the back? It won't let me get into the wireless network. So you're just going to have to imagine this picture of basically the land that he owned. Are you going to take it away? Oh, wow. You are going to have to imagine it then. I'm going to have to imagine it. Basically, it was swampland. All he owned was a piece of swampland. And the problem with this land is that the mosquitoes were breeding around this swampland, which means the malaria rates were super high. Oh, you can see it there. Which meant there was a huge amount of poverty in this part of Soroti, northern Uganda. So when he sort of like joined this group and they said, look, what can you bring to the mix? He basically said, the only thing I possess, the only thing I own is a piece of swampland that's the cause of suffering in this part of Uganda. I've got nothing else to give. And this group said, well, let's try and think differently, like a little bit more entrepreneurially about this land. So they started throwing out ideas, and eventually they came up with this idea. What if we get 20 men from the local community to dig up this swampland and to commit to digging for 30 days and see if we can dig a pond? So they start digging, and they keep digging, and they keep digging, and a week goes by, no breakthrough. You can see pretty much all my slides there if you look at the screen. They keep digging. Week two, no breakthrough. They keep digging. Week three, no breakthrough. They keep digging. And after 30 days, if you go to the next photo... in fact, why don't you control it at the back? That would be fun. Oh, you've done it. Unbelievable. Round of applause for Josh. Oh, and that's what happens at the end of 30 days. And it felt a little bit like Eden as I was looking at this land. Unbelievable. So they've dug this pond, and they start breeding fish in the pond. And for whatever reason, the conditions for the fish are just absolutely immense. So the fish start breeding super fast. And with the fish, they start feeding people in the local community, which is amazing news, right? In a place of extreme poverty, they're beginning to feed the wider community. But there's more than enough fish for the community. So they start taking some of the fish to market, and they start selling some of the fish and generating an income. And with that income, they decide they're going to employ a couple of people from the community to watch over and look after the ponds. You can see behind it there's a second pond, and they had a vision for building three other ponds. So they're feeding the local community, which is amazing. They're employing people in the local community to look after the ponds. There was more than enough fish from the second pond to do just those two things. So they decided that with the excess money, they'll start paying for the kids in the area to get an education, to send them to school. Because we all know that education is a key pathway out of poverty, which was amazing news. But it gets better than that. So they're feeding people, they're employing people, they're educating people, but there was more than enough fish to sell at the market, so they kept selling them, and with the extra money, they start building homes for people in the local community, which is amazing, right? But it gets better than that. So they're feeding the people, they're employing the people, they're educating the young children, they're providing homes for people, and they start asking the question, why are the conditions so amazing for the fish? Like, we weren't expecting this, what's going on? And what they realized, the conditions were so perfect because the fish were feeding off the mosquito larvae. So as the fish were feeding off the mosquito larvae, the malaria rates completely plummet. So this land that was quite literally killing people in the local area, it was the cause of suffering and poverty in Sarotti, becomes the land that's feeding people, educating the young children, employing people, providing homes and bringing malaria rates down. And we just walked around this pond and it was like, wow, this is amazing. This is amazing. It's one of the signs of development when it's done well, is when you go and visit the projects, they don't ask you for anything. They didn't say, can you bring a team to, you know, dig a, you know, whatever else, or can you bring a team to build a school or whatever else? They were just like, can we show you what we've done? As we've been empowered by the Spirit and taken ownership for our community, can we show you what we've done? And as a team there, we were just like, wow, amazing. How incredible is that? I love that story. So when I got back to the UK, I said to the church at KXC, we were a few years old at the time, so look, I want to tell you about this guy I met in Sarotti, and just told them the pond story and said, look, you know, we have poverty right on our doorstep in King's Cross. We've got one of the toughest estates just behind the station called the Bemerton Estate, where, you know, just all sorts of poverty, young kids getting in gangs, isolated elderly, homelessness, drug addiction, the list goes on. You know, it's a very different kind of poverty to what I've seen in Uganda, but why don't we ask the question, what do we have in our hand right now that we could contribute to what God wants to do in this area and that could serve the people of King's Cross? So we started asking the question, what do we have in our hand? And the answer at that point was 15,000 square foot of office space that was rent free. Now, let me just very briefly tell you that story. As I said, we're an Anglican church, but not a parish church. So we meet in other people's buildings. And when we planted the church, our office was the spare room of our flat. We only had one child at the time. So in the spare room, three of us who were part-time on staff and worked from that room. And after about 18 months, we were just beginning to grow the team, and we were like, we can't fit two extra people in the spare room. Like, it's never going to happen. So, Lord, like, you're going to have to provide. And get a phone call from someone called John Burns, who used to work at YFC, Youth for Christ, a really good friend. And he phoned me up and said, Pete, one of my friends has invested heavily in office space in King's Cross, just up York Way. But then the credit crunch hit. And he's been left with like loads of offices that he just can't let commercially. And he phoned me up to say, do you know any organizations, churches, charities that are looking for rent-free office space for the next year or two whilst the market sort of gradually picks up? The deal is there's nothing permanent about this. If the market picks up tomorrow, they have to be out tomorrow. You get a 24-hour notice period. But if you know anyone that would want space, give them a call. So John was like, okay, I think I do know some people. So picked up the phone to me. And essentially said, Pete, do you want one office, which was about 2,000 square foot of office space? Do you want 2,000 square foot of office space rent-free for the next year or so, maybe? And I said, can I have a little think and pray about it? Yes. Yes, I would. So we move in to Tile Yard Studios, and we're there for about another 18 months. And it was incredible provision for us. We're a new church. And as I said, we were just trying to find our way. And when God provides 2,000 square foot of office space in one of the most expensive parts of London, that blows your mind, right? For us as a church, it was like, God, you're going to look after us. We're so grateful. It felt like manna in the desert or quail in the desert as we were journeying towards the destination of what God has for us as a church. Anyway, at the end of 18 months, we get the phone call. Basically, the landlord saying, you know, I'm not going to kick you out tomorrow, but the market's picking up. We're showing people around. So in the next few days, I want you to sort of get your plans together to move out. We were like, oh, Lord, please, like you provided so generously, look after us. Now, preachers exaggerate, right? Colin does, definitely. I do from time to time. This is exactly how the story happened. We get a phone call from a lady from Singapore that we'd never met before. She knows nothing about the church, and she just said, look, wanted to get in touch. I own a 7-story office block right down in King's Cross on Pentonville Road. We want to essentially redevelop the whole thing because King's Cross is going through a massive redevelopment, but it's going to take us 2 or 3 years to sort of get our plans together. And so we're just figuring out if we could get some charities in, that means we could get rate relief from the building. So I've just done a Google search for charities in King's Cross and found King's Cross Church, KXC, and wondered if you'd want one of the floors, which is 5,000 square foot of office space. It would be rent-free probably for the next 2 or 3 years, and just wondering if you're interested. And I think our response was, can we just have a little think and pray about it? Yes. Yes, we would. So we move out of Tyard Studios and we move into York House, as it was known. And we move into the bottom floor, 5,000 square foot, which is massive, by the way. It was way more than what we needed. So we said to some of our mission partners, like, we've been blessed with this incredible space. Like, do you want to sort of come and share the space with us? We said to Food Bank, like, the more the merrier. You come and work from the space. And we said to Only Connect, working with ex-offenders, you come and work from the space. And Choices, working with vulnerable mums, you come and work from the space. And Mums the Word, a closed bank, you come. And XLP, working with gangs, you come. So we all moved into this space and started working together, which was huge fun. And after a year, the lady from Singapore got in touch and said, look, you know, the floor above you, we never got rid of it. Like, do you want another 5,000 square foot of office space? Can we have a little think about it? Yes, we would. So we moved in like 6 months later, third floor. Do you want another 5,000 square foot? And yes, we did. So we eventually ended up with 15,000 square foot in King's Cross, one of the most expensive parts of London, rent-free. Now, we've lost it all now, and we're back into the Lord, please, would you provide? But the point of the story is unbelievable provision, right? When we got given the second floor, we didn't know what to do with it. So we're like, Lord, this is what we have in our hand right now. Whatever you want to do, like, use it for your glory. And a number in the church were praying, just had this idea of what if we create a co-working space where we just say to freelancers and creatives and business startups and social enterprises, why don't you come and work and collaborate with one another? And the idea was we'd take the second floor, which looked like this. It was called Tent. It looked like this, like a rundown, tired office space. And the idea was we were going to strip it out and we were going to populate that office space with waste furniture. So literally we had teams going around the streets of Islington and King's Cross, finding scaffolding planks, sanding them down, building tables, finding chairs with three legs, like grab it, you know, build a fourth leg, wardrobes. And we just put all this stuff that had been restored into the office, and it was called Tent. And it looked like this. You can see top left, that's one of the tables that had been built. And this is someone with a camera just walking through the space. And we started with 5 or 6 freelancers from KXC. And then you know, week by week, month by month, people started joining. And towards the end, we had a membership of well over 100 people. Every day, there'd have been more than 50 people or so working from that space. The vast majority weren't Christians, but working in the office with us, which meant we could build connections in the local community, particularly with creatives and freelancers. And it was just such an exciting story to be a part of this, like, rundown office space that was being restored and created a community where people, and particularly businesses, and social enterprises could flourish. And we just love the story of Tent. I want to tell you another story of a charity that was birthed in Tent, a social enterprise, really. It's called Rubies in the Rubble. A lady from KXC, Jenny Dawson, now Jenny Costa, just got married. She was working for a hedge fund and doing really well there. But one of the issues that just God broke her heart for was the issue of food waste and hunger worldwide. And you all know some of the stats that 2 billion tons of food is thrown out each year. 2 billion tons of food. All the while, 1 billion people on the planet tonight will go to bed hungry. 2 billion tons just thrown out. All those two-for-one offers that we think's great deal and then we never get around to using it and just chuck it out. In the West particularly, we're throwing away food all of the time, constant. And yet 1 billion people go to bed hungry tonight, many at the point of starvation. And she thought, you know what, I just can't do nothing on my watch. Can't sit back and do nothing. So she had this idea, what if I quit working for the hedge fund? My mum's got a really good chutney recipe. What if I go to markets and just say, can I get hold of all your waste fruit and veg? And what if I train up some women who are coming out of the sex industry or vulnerable backgrounds, and I teach them how to make these chutneys, and then we'll sell them back to market. So she did that. So she started, you know, going to the market, picking up the waste fruit and veg, employing vulnerable women to make these chutneys, and sold them back at Borough Market. And eventually they moved on because people at Borough Market loved it, and they were being invited to other markets. And then eventually, and this is what tends to happen when God's favor is totally upon a business or a project like this, people started getting involved, saying we want to help out, we want to be part of the story. So Jamie Oliver got in touch, said, look, I love these chutneys, not going to lie to you, I want to use them in my restaurants. Pret a Manger got in touch, said, love these chutneys, we want to use them in our sandwiches. Waitrose came along, we love these chutneys, can we sell them in our stores? So now they're in 30 stores across London. There's plans to take it far beyond just London. But starting with just one girl saying, I can't do nothing on my watch. And suddenly, you know, the business gathers momentum. She won Ben & Jerry's Social Entrepreneur of the Year. She then went on to win the Verve Clicquot Women Entrepreneur of the Year. And all of this was happening in Tent and within our church family. So these stories, it's like a domino effect, right? The pond story. He doesn't even know about KXC. He'll probably never know about the church. But like his story, his example, domino, Tent, domino, Rubies in the Rubble. And these stories just got under our skin as a church. Like I would tell them regularly. People were bored by the stories towards the end. But I tell you why we love these stories is because when we started the church 5.5 years ago, we had a number of value statements. One of our value statements is we want to be a church that's shaped by the biblical narrative, that indwells the biblical narrative. Biblical narrative is just the most incredible story of restoration. And all of these mini stories were pointing to the macro story, like a story of your pond being restored or being built from waste, kind of swamp land. The story of Tent, the story of Rubies in the Rubble, these are restoration stories that pointed towards this story where we were trying to find our identity. We were trying to find our belonging in the narrative. We were trying to find our purpose in the present in the narrative, our hope for the future in the narrative. So we started talking about the biblical narrative as a story that moves from creation to decreation to recreation. So creation, you know the story, Garden of Eden. God creates humanity out of the overflow of his love and creates this garden of perfection. And within the garden, within relationship with God, humanity can flourish. No sin, no sickness, no suffering. Humanity fully alive, flourishing in every way possible. Naked, unashamed, living the dream, right? At least I think that's living the dream. So you've just got this beautiful picture. And then you know what happens in Genesis 3, like sin enters the story. And because of sin, essentially selfishness, Martin Luther defines sin as a life turned in on itself, where everything's about you, your longings, your needs, your ambitions, your goals, that's all that really matters. And when you've got 8 billion people living like that, That's why you have so much dysfunction and pain and suffering in the world. But that's essentially what happens. Sin enters the story and created order unravels. All of created order unravels. So violence enters the story. And then you have the story of the escalation of violence. So Cain kills his brother Abel, nations turns against nations. And then you have this tragic verse, one of the absolute low points in the whole of the narrative of Scripture in Genesis 6, where it says the earth was filled with violence and God's heart was filled with pain. If you know the story from the beginning, the idea is that Adam and Eve are told to populate the earth, to have kids, and to expand Eden, the garden, until Eden fills the earth. And as they populate and have kids, the kids carrying the presence of God, so the presence of God will fill the earth. And yet in Genesis 6, things have gone so horribly wrong that we're told the earth is filled not with the presence of God or the glory of God, but violence. And God's heart is filled with pain. So that's, you know, an absolute low point. But then in Genesis 12, you have the beginning of the story of recreation, of God choosing Abraham, saying, I'm going to make you a father to a nation. And through that nation, the nation of Israel, I want to bring healing and restoration and redemption. I want to restore things to how they were meant to be. And as you know the story, Israel screw up constantly. You know, they fall short. And so God wraps himself in human flesh in the person of Jesus Christ. He's the true human, the true Israel, the one that fulfills Israel's story. And Israel's calling to bring healing, restoration, redemption, the new creation. And that's the climactic moment in the whole story. But then, the very end of the story, Revelation 21, 22. And this is the bit that breaks my heart. The church has done a really bad job of telling the end of our story. I've done a really bad job historically of telling the end of our story. So much so, if you were to head into sort of Finchley and ask people on the street, like, what do you understand about the end of the Christian story? I think people would say something like this. Well, this is what Christians believe, that at the end of it all, or when you die, essentially what's going to happen, you're going to leave your body behind and your soul will ascend to the divine realm and you'll enjoy some sort of disembodied bliss, hanging out with the angels, drinking Red Bull, playing harps, you know, something like that. And I'm not going to lie, I quite like that story. I just quite like the idea of drinking Red Bull with the angels. But the problem with the story has got nothing to do with the New Testament. Nothing to do with the teachings of Jesus. Nothing to do with the teachings of Paul. Everything to do with a guy called Plato, a Greek philosopher. Our story doesn't end like that. It doesn't even come close to ending like that. Here's the end of our story, and this is Revelation 21, 22, the last two chapters. Instead of us ascending to the divine realm to enjoy some sort of disembodied bliss, heaven, best defined, biblically speaking, as the place where God lives, heaven comes down. Not we ascend. Heaven comes down, and God makes his dwelling place with humanity, and he restores everything to how it was meant to be. And the Apostle John is writing down this vision, and the climactic moment in this vision, he sees God sit down on his throne, which is indicative of his work finally being complete, and God says, behold, I am making all things new. Let me tell you why that's phenomenal. In the Greek language, the New Testament is written mainly in Greek. In the Greek language, you've got two words for new. You've got neos, which means brand new, and you've got kainos, which is something old that's made new. In other words, it's restored to its former glory. And when God sits down on his throne, he says, behold, I'm making all things kainos, not neos. Not this version went horribly wrong of creation. I mean, Adam and Eve messed up, and everyone else has been messing up ever since. Let's scrap that. Let's try again. No. Not that end of the story. Behold, I'm making all things kainos. In other words, I'm going to restore everything to how it was meant to be. So how was it meant to be? Well, you go back to Genesis 1 and 2. No sin, no sickness, no suffering. Humanity fully alive in the presence of God. And the Apostle John is writing down this vision and he can see it unfold. And he says, look, I could see everything being restored and made new. And I could see there was no death anymore, no grief, no crying, no pain. The former things, in other words, decreated order is passing away. And God is building the new creation, humanity fully alive in the presence of God. That's the end of our story. It beats Red Bull with the angels, right? It totally beats Red Bull with the angels. Like, when did we stop telling the end of our story? It's the most glorious end. And these stories of, like, swamplands becoming a pond, lifting a community out of poverty, and, you know, waste office space becoming co-working space where social enterprises can begin, and fruit and veg that was being thrown out, suddenly being restored to make incredible chutneys and employing vulnerable people back into the workplace. Like, these all point towards the ultimate story of restoration. We've got to tell our story better, right? We've got to tell our story better. So how does God go about making all things new? Philippians 2, did I mention that we will eventually get there? Some of you are thinking, I'm pretty sure he said we were going to get there. Well, we've got there. Philippians 2, this is how Paul answers that question. If the end of our story is God making all things new, just so you know, that is the vision that God has for St. Bees in North Finchley. He wants to use St. Bees as a community by which he's going to make all things new in Finchley. And communities lifted out of poverty and individual lives rescued and brought to fullness of life. How's God going to do that? Now, the Sunday school answer, which is the right answer, is Jesus. But Paul wants to unpack a little bit of how it's Jesus. So he basically quotes what many theologians would say is one of the earliest worship songs that we have from the early church. Now, it's broken down, and I've broken it down so you can see it clearly, into three verses, essentially. I couldn't find a big chorus or a middle eight that keeps building, you know, the drums getting bigger and bigger, and then eventually goes back into a climactic chorus. I couldn't find that in Philippians 2. So it's just three verses. But within these three verses, you get the hint of what Paul, how Paul would answer this question. How does God make all things new in Christ? So let's look at verse 1. He's talking about Jesus, who being in very nature God, did not consider equality with God something to be used to his own advantage. Rather, he made himself nothing, taking the very nature of a servant, being made in human likeness. That's verse 1. Now, essentially, what is verse 1 about? You'll see it on the screen now. It's about the incarnation, a theological term I know. The Greek word incarne literally means in flesh. It's the idea that God wrapped himself in human flesh. And we're going to celebrate this in our carol services, you know, as we celebrate the Christmas story, that God became a baby born in a manger, not in a palace, not, you know, to dominate over, but to serve, born in this stable, surrounded, no doubt, by animal excrement. Like, he enters the mess. Like, he jumps into decreation. He's born into decreation. A Jewish family. In the first century, being ruled over by the Romans. Now, this is the God we worship, not a distant deity, like God Emmanuel, God with us, God who draws alongside. I want to give you two very quick stories that maybe point towards the incarnation, because it is the most beautiful idea of God that God would jump into the pit for us to lead us out. So the first one, anyone watch The West Wing? Okay, well, one fan and then a number of people who have watched it. This is a fable that I've lifted from The West Wing. And it comes in the story where Leo is helping someone journey through an alcohol addiction. But he tells this story to the guy as essentially saying, I'm there for you, I'm alongside you. He tells the story of a guy who falls into a pit. And from this pit, he just can't escape. But he can see the world going past. And he's just shouting for help. Like, help, somebody, I've fallen into this pit. Can someone come and rescue me? And then eventually he sees a doctor walk past. And he's like, doctor, please, please don't leave me down here. Like, do something, rescue me. And the doctor begins to write on a piece of paper and then folds it up and throws it into the pit. And the guy in the pit just opens it up and it's like a prescription. It's like, that's not going to help me. And looks up, but the doctor's gone. So just carries on shouting, like, please, somebody help me. And he sees a priest walk past. And he starts shouting at the priest, vicar, father, pastor, whatever you call yourself. Like, don't leave me down here. Please, like, rescue me. Like, get help. And the priest stops and he just starts writing on this piece of paper. Folds it up and throws it into the pit. And the guy reads it and it's a prayer. And it's like, this isn't going to help. And the guy's gone. And eventually he carries on shouting, but eventually he sees his friend walk past and he starts shouting at his friend, like, mate, it's me. I don't want to die down here. Like, do something, send help. And his friend jumps into the pit and he looks at his friend. He's like, you idiot. Like, well, what are you thinking? Like, you can't help me if you're stuck down here with me. And the friend says, no, I've actually been down here before and I know a way out. So you just come and follow me. And I remember watching that and just thinking, what a beautiful picture of the incarnation. That God jumps into the pit. Like he doesn't just throw down a message. That's how some people understand God. That essentially in the Bible we have this message of like, if you do X, if you do Y, if you live a good and moral upright life, then you'll get out of the pit. I've given you the commands of how to get out of the pit. No, that isn't our story. Karl Barth wants to find religion as the height of our rebellion against God. Like this idea that we could somehow earn our way out of the pit. That's not our story. It's not our faith. Our faith revolves around God jumping into the pit. The word became flesh. Not just a message, but a messenger. The word became flesh and dwelt amongst us so that he could open the door to freedom and lead us out. Second story then. A friend of mine, a mum, was telling me this. And mums in the room will know that when you take your kids out to the park, sometimes that can be super stressful, right? Just getting their coats on, getting them in the buggy. And she was having one of those days. She was just trying to get the kids ready. And eventually, she's got two kids, eventually got them ready. She put the youngest one in the buggy, little baby, and then the toddler was going to walk behind. And they're getting out of the door, got the pram out of the door. And then a gust of wind slams the door shut. So she, the mum, is outside with the buggy, with the baby, and the toddler's behind this door that slams shut. And she's like, oh, that's so annoying. Just goes to get her keys. Like to open the door, and it's like, oh my goodness, I can't find my keys, I can't find my keys. And within milliseconds, the toddler's like, nah! Like, mummy, please, I want to go to the park with you. I want to go, I'll be really good. I promise you, I won't do whatever I did again. Like, please. And the mum's like, I don't know what I've done with the keys. And then remember, she left the keys on the kitchen table. And the toddler's screaming from behind the closed door. And the mum's like, I don't know what to do. I don't know what to do. And starts shouting instructions. Like, all you've got to do is mummy left the keys on the kitchen table. Can you go and get them? Post them through the letterbox. But the kid can't hear because she's screaming, mummy! So the mum starts trying to shout louder. And you have this scene of like mum, door, toddler, and just shouting. And the mum gets to the moment where she's like, I just can't do this. I don't know what to do. Like, I don't know what to do. And she just felt like God say to her, like, stop shouting commands at your daughter and just empathize. Like, stop shouting instructions. Just listen to your daughter. So the mum crouches down and opens up the letterbox and puts her hand through. And it's like, it's all right, mummy's here. I promise you, I'm not going to go anywhere. Mummy's here. It's okay. It's okay. I know you're upset and I know you're scared. I'm not going to go anywhere. I'm not going anywhere. And gradually the toddler calms down, and then eventually the mum says, all of this is a conversation through the letterbox, I was so silly, I left my keys on the kitchen table, can you run and get them for me and bring them back and post them through the letterbox? And the toddler runs off, runs back, posts the keys through, they open up the door, and you have this phenomenal embrace. Like, that's the message of Christmas, right? That's the incarnation. Some of us here, but a lot of us outside the church, have this understanding of God being a distant deity, an angry father. They've completely misunderstood, like, our story is a loving father who jumps into the pit and says, it's all right, I'm here, I'm here, I'm here. I love this about Jesus. The names matter massively, biblically speaking, right? There's such loaded names in the Bible. The name Jesus, Aramaic, is Yahshua. Literally means Yahweh saves. The Hebrew term for salvation is Yasha. Literally means to be led to a wide open space. To be led to a wide open space. That's how the Jewish people understand salvation. So the Aramaic name Jesus, Yahshua, which the root word is Yasha, literally means Yahweh, in other words, God, will lead you to a wide open space. So the name of Jesus contains the mission of Jesus. He's the one that's going to open the door behind which we've been screaming and shouting for help. He's going to open the door and lead people to a wide open space. That sounds a lot like Eden, right? A wide open space where we can flourish in relationship with God. That's the message that comes through at Christmas. And if that's what Paul says, how does God make all things new? And the answer, the first move God makes is to enter the pain, is towards the poor. Then if we're to be part of this mission of Jesus to make all things new, what's our first move? Of the church. The first move of the church is towards the poor. It's towards the pain. It's into the pit. Like, and you can't do that in a sanitized way. Like, at a distance, we're going to throw money in. We're praying for you. All the best down there. We're praying for you. No, the church is to jump into the pit. And this is what the early church demonstrated to us. The first move we make is towards the pain, and that's why we need compassion. And you can see behind the 2020 Capital Vision of the Diocese, that's one of the things they're trying to emphasize, is if we're going to be the church, you cannot do it without compassion. You cannot do it without a broken heart. You can't. Can't do it without a broken heart. We need compassion. Second verse then, I'll speed up. Verse 8, being found in the appearance as a man, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to death, even death on the cross. So the first move, the Creator wraps himself in human flesh in the person of Jesus and steps into the pain. And the second thing, he dies a brutal death on our behalf so that we could experience the life that we were made for. There's two things that are important about this. Number one, it gives us a message to proclaim. And secondly, it gives us a life to live, a message to proclaim. Paul was like passionate about this. He says, for the message of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, but to us who's being saved, it's the power of God. In other words, he's saying to the church, you cannot stop communicating the cross. Like, it will offend and it might be seen as irrelevant, but if you stop communicating the cross, there's no power left in the story. If you extract the cross from the narrative we've been looking at, it becomes impotent. There's no power in it, which is why Paul said, I'm not ashamed of the gospel, this news about the crucified and risen Lord Jesus. I'm not ashamed of the gospel because it's the power of God for the salvation, yasha, opening up into a wide open space. It's the power of God for the salvation of everyone who believes. So I'm going to preach the cross and some people are going to get offended. And do you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to carry on preaching the cross. And I'll be sent to prison, but do you know what I'll do then? I'll carry on preaching the cross because that is where the power is to be found. How is God going to make all things new? He's going to jump into the pit and draw near to the pain and he's going to die a brutal death, and that's where the power is to be found. And he'll open the door to fullness of life. We've got to be a generation that keeps proclaiming the message of Christ crucified. And the temptation will be to make this message more palatable. Let's just extract the cross from the story. All this other stuff about God making all things new, that's fun. Like, let's tell that stuff. No, you've got to tell the message that Jesus died to open the door to life. And secondly, then, it's a life to live. Jesus said, whoever wants to be my disciple, you've got to deny yourself, take up your cross and follow me. This is an example of how to live. I want to read you a very brief story of Count Zinzendorf. I'm going to tell you the story partly because I just love the guy's name. But an incredible missionary became a Moravian bishop. And the Moravians had this outpouring of the Spirit. And because of that outpouring, like a Pentecost, they sent missionaries all over the world to some of the most desperate and dark places. And this is the story of one such group of missionaries going to the Danish West Indies. So let me read you the story. In April 1731, the young count met an African slave from the Danish West Indies who told him of the terrible conditions facing the plantation workers. He returned to Herna in July and shared the story. In response, two of the Moravians volunteered to go to the West Indies, even if it meant selling themselves into slavery. Pause. Like, wow. I mean, that's jumping into the pit, right? If it's the first move, like the incarnation, God jumping into the pain, these guys are like, well, we'll just sell ourselves into slavery. If that's the only way we're going to reach the slaves, then so be it. Like, wow. Let me carry on reading. On August 21st, the following year, the first two missionaries left on foot for Copenhagen. On October the 8th, they finally set sail for America, and 5 days later, they arrived in the West Indies. The Moravian missionaries worked hard, but having given up everything for these people, after 18 months, they'd gained just one convert. Like, wow, 18 months, one convert. 17 more Moravians arrived to join them in June 1734, eight of whom died of yellow fever. Undaunted, 11 more missionaries arrived in February, and four of them died in their first 2 months. In 1735, most of the survivors were forced to return to Hernut, three of whom drowned in a shipwreck. The whole enterprise must have seemed like the most costly failure imaginable. However, in 1736, there were signs that the tide might be starting to turn, and a little while later, Zinzendorf traveled to visit the colony. Unaware of recent encouragements, he turned nervously to his traveling companion as their ship landed and said, suppose the brethren are no longer here, what shall we do? In that case, replied his friend, we're here. Like, this is incredible faith, isn't it? Like, in that case, we're here. In fact, they discovered a church of 800 people sown in the blood of so many martyrs. And you probably know the rest of the story, like revival spread through the West Indies. But the story that we often don't tell is these crazy Moravians who, like, we'll give whatever it takes to preach the message of Christ crucified, and we won't just preach it, we're going to live that out in our lives. And there's a verse that Paul says of Jesus that I love in Corinthians. He said, Jesus, though rich, became poor so that others might become rich. And that follows the shape of the narrative, right? This isn't prosperity gospel right here, a way to get rich. Paul is saying of Jesus, Jesus, though rich in terms of life, not finances, like he didn't have a home or a base, he's like, though rich in terms of life, in other words, fully alive, became poor in terms of life, in other words, died a brutal death, so that others, you and I, could become rich in terms of life, living life fully as we were made for. And Paul says that's the model of Jesus. So, and that's what I want you to follow. Though rich, becoming poor, emptying yourself so that others could become rich. And that's what the Moravians were doing, and revival broke out as a result. So we're going to need courage, right, to proclaim it and to live it out. And the final verse, therefore God exalted him to the highest place and gave him the name that's above every name, that at the name of Jesus every knee should bow in heaven and on earth and under the earth, and every tongue acknowledge that Jesus Christ is Lord, to the glory of God the Father. How does God make all things new? And the answer is Jesus. How? The incarnation, he wraps himself in human flesh. He dies a brutal death on our behalf, and he rises to new life and then says, come follow me. Immerse yourself in this story. The story that ends with God sitting down and saying, behold, I'm making all things kainos. And how do we do it? We become people of compassion, that our hearts get broken for the vulnerable, for those on the margins, for those that don't know Jesus. We become courageous, we communicate this gospel, and we live it out, and we become super creative, finding ways to live out this story, whether it be through ponds, co-working spaces, chutneys, or a load of different ideas. We live out this faith in our day-to-day lives, and as we do that faithfully, God does his bit, which only he can do. He makes all things new. He makes all things kainos. So why don't we stand?